So good evening, everybody. Thank you for being here. So this is week three of our Dharma seminar on the Satipatthana Sutra. So week three, the seat is almost becoming comfortable. And so the past 2 weeks, we've been studying the Satipatthana Sutra. And it's one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha, initially passed down orally in Pali, and then passed down to us through centuries of reciting, writing, interpreting, reading, many, many times, translating. And it's a record of a sermon given by the by the Buddha that teaches the importance of mindfulness and gives detailed instructions on what to be mindful of and how to do it. So I'd like to think of the accumulated power and wisdom that's collected through all of this repetition. And it actually seems outside of the actual words that are used to transmit it. And different scholars have interpreted the words in different ways as it's come through the ages. And indeed, it's helpful to explore these so as not to get too stuck on the words themselves. But I actually think that the essence of the teaching penetrates beyond our literal understanding. And it's magnified by the many, many times it's been read and spoken. And to be honest, sometimes I think that if only I were smarter or more of a scholar, I would understand the teachings better, and I'd be able to give amazing Dharma talks, illuminating the Dharma with elegant phrases and wit. But in the Fukken Zazengi, which is Dogen's Universal Recommendations for Zazen, a fascicle that we sometimes chant during services, Dogen says, with respect to the bringing about of enlightenment, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and the sharp-witted, there is no distinction. If you concentrate your effort single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. And I find this very comforting. So not so much effort is needed to be smart and understand the words. But if we truly let ourselves sink in and concentrate our efforts single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. And he goes on, practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. So the teaching of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutra is essentially this, to concentrate our effort single-mindedly. Have our minds, our attention, our awareness deeply penetrate all aspects of our existence so that we become one with it. And as it says in the sutra, to do this while observing from within and from without, while observing the process of coming to be and the process of dissolution, until understanding and full awareness come about, not caught up in any worldly consideration. And to have it be a matter of everydayness. So to cultivate continuous mindfulness throughout the day, whatever posture we're in, whatever actions or activities occur, whatever thoughts and feelings arise. So in this sutra, there are four foundations or realms of our existence that we're directed to be mindful of, to pay attention to and really get to know intimately. And we went through the first two foundations in the last 2 weeks, and I'm just going to briefly review them again. So the first one is mindfulness of the body. And study of the body brings familiarity, peace, and harmony to the body. And it helps us realize the three basic observations of Buddhism, selflessness, or no separate self, impermanence, and interdependent origination. And this allows us to return to ourselves, to come home and come in contact with life in the present moment, because the body's always in the present moment. And it helps us to realize that our body's not separate, not just my body, not apart from other bodies. The body's not so much an object as a sort of a process or an experience, a flow that we share with everybody else. So it's really helped me not take being me quite so personally, to kind of study this way of being mindful of the body. And in this first part of the sutta, the first foundation, there are about five meditation practices that are given to encourage mindfulness of the body, and just to say them again. So the first one is using the breathing to bring breath to the body, to be mindful of it, and to calm the body. The next one is being aware of the posture, positions, and movement of the body. So standing, lying, walking, sitting. We do that during Kinhin and during all the movements during the day. And the next one was being aware of the impurity of the body and of all the parts that make it up. So just being aware of all the bones, muscles, brain, kidney, liver, all the parts of the body. And then the next part was being aware of the elements that make up the body. And then finally, observing how the body decomposes after death. So the monks were instructed to go to the charnel grounds and just really observe all the stages of decay as our bodies return to the earth. And during that, all the instructions in the sutra were counseled to observe the body from within and from without. And I've struggled a bit to understand what that means, to observe the body from within and from without, and we talked about it before, but I've kept thinking about it and reading, and most of the commentaries that I've read on the sutra do suggest that being aware of the body from within is being aware of our own bodies, our own sort of internal reality, and being aware of the body from without is being aware of others around us, so being aware of the other bodies that are within our vicinity, how they move, how they breathe, what they feel, what they think. And I've sometimes thought, well, being aware of my body from within is that internal sensation, which we can all have, and being aware from without is, you know how sometimes you observe your body, you think, well, how would other people see me? Like, maybe that's another way of observing from without. But the whole thing of observing other bodies would be quite difficult for a hermit to practice, I think. Mm-hmm. So. It's a bit of an oversight. But as I've been sort of thinking about this and practicing with it over the past weeks, I've noticed a bit of a shift in how I feel about others, both familiar people and strangers. And I've started to have increasing feelings of kindness towards other people. And in noticing this, I realized that the sense of separateness that I've always felt from others is fading a little bit as I see them not as foreign and potentially threatening other people, but more as beings that share the same reality as me, the same process of embodiment, the same elements as me. You have a physical reality. You experience Vedanas. You have minds, all subject to the same karmic principles as me. So I have less sense of me versus everyone else. So I'm just going to briefly dip into one of these meditation practices from that first foundation. And I've been mainly using a translation by Thich Nhat Hanh in his book, Transformation and Healing. So it says, further, in whichever position his body happens to be, the practitioner passes in review the elements which constitute the body. In this body is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. As a skilled butcher or an apprentice butcher, having killed a cow, might sit at the crossroads to divide the cow into many parts, the practitioner passes in review the elements which comprise his very own body. Here in this body are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So just take a minute now to tune in to the nature of your own body. So if you were to break it down, you break down your body into its elements and put them into four piles. These would be piles of air, piles of water, piles of fire, piles of earth. And actually, really only the earth one would be making a nice neat pile, and you can see why it's pretty handy that we have skin to contain all of these elements. But those are the four elements that make up our bodies. And think of how these elements come to you through breathing, drinking, and eating, and metabolizing. And there's a constant flow of these elements into and out of your body. So this interbeing with all that is in the universe is one of the principal ways of witnessing for ourselves the non-self, unborn, and never dying nature of all that is. I'm quite used to thinking of the parts of the body. It's interesting because there's all these different meditation practices, and one of them is being aware of the different parts. And in my medical training and practice, that's something we focus on quite a lot, but not used to thinking of the elements that make up our body. It's an interesting part of the mindfulness training. And I was walking the dog this morning, and there's a lot of crows in our neighborhood that are nesting now, so they're out picking up branches and getting quite close to us. And I was thinking about the elements, and I thought, well, the crow's body has the very same elements. They've got water, earth, air, and fire. And I passed a really beautiful daffodil. It's the same elements in all of these things. It's a nice feeling of being at one with everything. And I really like this quote, Paula Arai, in her introduction to Zenju Earthen Manual's book, The Shamanic Bones of Zen. She says, "As humans, we are organic, impermanent forms of congealed earth who channel water, animate fire, and circulate air. And we are capable of embodying flowing wellsprings of love." So we are simply that, and also something more. So then, moving to the second foundation, that's the mindfulness of the feelings in the feelings. And in this, we closely observe the arising, the presence, and the disappearance of feelings, which can be pleasant, painful, or neutral. Or to say another way, a positive, negative, or neutral, to borrow a term used to describe the valence or charge of atoms. And these feelings can have a basis in psychological, physical, or physiological stimuli. So for an example, to get, say, a positive vedana or a positive pleasant feeling from a physical source, it might be to go out from a cold outside and into a warm room, and that feels good, so you get a pleasant feeling, a pleasant vedana. And painful could be you stub your toe and get some pain, and that you might feel a negative charge towards that. Physiological, if you a pleasant one might be triggered by having a good meal, feeling satisfied. And a negative valence about from a physiological basis could be from not getting enough sleep, being really tired. And then psychological, you could feel positive from doing something really fun with people you like. Negative could be from feeling fear and not liking that sensation. So these are just really simple positive, negative, or neutral. And they're deep conditioned responses that are rooted in our culture, our past experiences, and our learning. So the Buddha recognized that with nearly every perception that we notice, whether of a thought, sensation, emotion, or action, comes an emotional or feeling charge that's either positive, negative, or neutral. So we either like or dislike or don't care about them to some degree, however small that is. So we have a subtle preference for or against pretty much everything that we are aware of or encounter. So you could say, well, why is it so important to cultivate an awareness of these vedanas, these kind of primal little impulses, reactions that we have? Because although they are often reflexive and subconscious, they lead to thoughts and actions. So they orient us toward a certain direction for our behavior. And it's like the amoeba that come in contact with something positive, they move toward it. Something negative, they move away. Something just neutral, they stay put. So it sort of moves us along in our life. So when we're aware of that, we become capable of adjusting our behavior if we're not moving in a direction that we want to be in. So that's the first and second foundations. Then the third one, which I'm going to focus on a bit more tonight, is mindfulness of the mind in the mind. So wrap your head around that one. So I'm going to read from the sutra again, and just that awareness too of how many times this sutra and this part of it has been chanted, memorized, written, translated, repeated, and just the power of that. And it's like through from the time of the Buddha, through all of our ancestors in different parts of the world, and now it's coming to us right here. And I think in a way, just by reading it and pondering it, we're kind of invoking that presence as well. So bhikkhus, how does a practitioner remain established in the observation of the mind in the mind? When his mind is desiring, the practitioner is aware, my mind is desiring. When his mind is not desiring, he is aware, my mind is not desiring. When her mind is hating something, she is aware, my mind is hating. When her mind is not hating, she is aware, my mind is not hating. When his mind is in a state of ignorance, he is aware, my mind is in a state of ignorance. When his mind is not in a state of ignorance, he is aware, my mind is not in a state of ignorance. When her mind is collected, she is aware, my mind is collected. When his mind is not collected, he is aware, my mind is not collected. When his mind is distracted, he is aware, my mind is distracted. When his mind is not distracted, he is aware, my mind is not distracted. Goes on. When her mind has a wider scope, she is aware, my mind has widened in scope. When her mind has a narrow scope, she is aware, my mind has become narrow in scope. When her mind is capable of reaching a higher state, she is aware, my mind is capable of reaching a higher state. When their mind is not capable of reaching a higher state, they are aware, my mind is not capable of reaching a higher state. When their mind is composed, they are aware, my mind is composed. When their mind is not composed, they are aware, my mind is not composed. When his mind is free, he is aware, my mind is free. When his mind is not free, he is aware, my mind is not free. This is how a practitioner remains established in the observation of the mind in the mind, observation of the mind from within or from without, or observation of the mind from both within and without. He remains established in the observation of the process of coming to be in the mind, or the process of dissolution in the mind, or both the process of coming to be and the process of dissolution. Or he's mindful of the fact, there is a mind here, until understanding and full awareness come about. She remains established in the observation, free, not caught up in any worldly consideration. This is how to practice observation of the mind in the mind, O bhikkhus. So we begin the mindfulness journey by paying attention to the body, to the physical reality, and then moving on to feelings in the second foundation. And in the second foundation, this is limited to the powerful but often subtle first reaction we have to any perception. And we then move on to more difficult to define foundations. So first of all, what is mind? And how do we become mindful of it? So we use our mind every time we are mindful. Thich Nhat Hanh is a thing, it's about your fingers rubbing together, mind being mindful of mind. And so to simplify things, I sometimes think of mind as consciousness, something that's also difficult to comprehend. My mother used to have a fridge magnet that had a picture of a large dog napping on the floor with a caption floating above its head saying, consciousness, that annoying interval between naps. So whenever we're alive and awake, and I'm not really sure what happens when we're sleeping or in a coma, but when we are awake, we have consciousness. And consciousness is a function of being embodied. Without the body, there's no consciousness. And also without consciousness, there's no body. And the sutra, we've done the first and second foundations, and we're now on the third one, which is mindfulness of the mind. The fourth foundation is mindfulness of objects of mind. We'll get into that more next week. And objects of mind are our thoughts and perceptions. So in a similar way, you could say mindfulness of the body, then if we're mindful of the objects of the body, it could be our bones and our liver and our brains. But the sutra doesn't go a mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of objects of the body. But there's mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of objects of mind. That's kind of curious. And I think that maybe the separation into the third and the fourth foundations is a little bit fluid of what we're looking at. With mind and objects of mind. And another book that I've been looking at in these past weeks, which I've been quite enjoying, is by Eric Harrison, who's an Australian meditation teacher, secular teacher. He studied a lot of Buddhism, but doesn't identify as a Buddhist or a spiritual teacher. But really very familiar with the Buddhist teachings and really respects them. And this book's Brain Training with the Buddha, A Modern Path to Insight Based on the Ancient Foundations of Mindfulness. And he's a little bit arrogant and pompous. And I really like this little part here I'm going to read. The thing is, he doesn't try to be anything else or sort of pretend he's not. But the sutta consists of an introduction and four training disciplines or foundations. Years ago, to help myself understand the text, I made an internal change to this structure. Despite its immense authority, the sutta looks like it was shaped into its present final form by a committee, which it probably was. All the Pali texts were originally held only in the memory of monks. The sutta was only put into written form about 300 years after the Buddha composed it. The individual components and subsections of the sutta are almost certainly accurate representations of the Buddha's words. We find them repeatedly elsewhere in the Pali Canon. However, the organization of the sutta itself seems awkward. Its last two categories are confused and illogical. I don't know for sure, but my guess is that this confusion is probably due to an error of judgment in the final editing. So, I don't actually, he kind of goes what he would change or how he would sort of recompose it. I don't think I really agree with him, but I like having that perspective because I've been brought up to kind of think that everything that's said in the sutras of the books is the absolute truth, just like in my Christian childhood, the Bible was true. And I think to have the mind of questioning things and say, do I agree or do I not agree, is really healthy. And the Buddha, in fact, said, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You know, it's to say, to not to give away your power or authority to anybody else. Anyway, to get back to the third foundation, what we're paying attention to is the quality of mind or our state of mind. So this is a more subtle observation and one we're often less experienced at than paying attention to our body or our thoughts. So states of mind can also be thought of as moods, kind of the general color or tone of our minds. So if your mind were a room and you were to walk in and turn on the light, for example, to be mindful of your mind, what would you see? And so this section that I read, it begins with being aware of whether or not the mind is a desiring mind. You know, something translated sometimes as a lustful mind or a wanting, where you're wanting or craving something. So whether your mind has that or doesn't have it, it's like, is it there or is it not there? And also whether or not the mind is hating or angry, so full of aversion or not. Whether or not the mind is in a state of ignorance or is deluded. So these are the three poisons that you sort of hear about, greed, anger, and delusion, sometimes called the three unwholesome roots. So that's what we're to pay attention to in our mind. We're instructed to notice if these roots or poisons are present or not present. Are they affecting our mind? And also to notice the process or nature of how they come to be and how they pass. To notice from within and from without. So again, is that noticing them in ourselves and also in other people? So in this way, we can become aware of what triggers these states of mind and to see how, with simple observation, they pass away in ourselves and others. And the next thing we're asked to observe are more like qualities of the mind. So is the mind collected or not collected, distracted or not distracted, a wide or narrow scope, which could relate to focus? Is the mind capable of reaching a higher state? Is it composed? So just notice right now for yourself, be mindful of your mind. Is it distracted or focused, expansive or contracted, calm or full of static? And you just sort of tune in and get a sense of the sort of state of your mind. So you could also say that mindfulness is like a light that we shine on things. It's like having a flashlight. And what kind of light are you using? Is it clear and strong and bright, or is it focused or unfocused, dim or scattered? What's the quality of your mind or your mindfulness? So in this way, we can be mindful of our mind. It's like aware of our awareness. And sometimes this is referred to as meta-awareness in modern cognitive science, aware of how we are being aware. So in the second and third foundations, awareness of feelings and states of mind, we start to recognize what modern psychologists usually refer to as a broader field called emotions. So another question, you can say, what is mind? But also, where is the mind located? So we usually think of it as being in the brain, but is it also or maybe in the heart? And there's a Buddhist term called the heart-mind, not distinguishing mind and heart. Is it in the gut, the lungs? Is it inside the body or outside the body or both? And neuroscience has studied the brain through brain scanning and imaging techniques and found sort of mapped out various mental functions. So they're linked with activity in specific brain regions. So sensations are processed in the sensory cortex at the top, back, and sides of the brain. Emotions are processed in the limbic system in the center of the brain. Thoughts are processed in the prefrontal cortex at the front. And actions initiated from the motor cortex, a strip across the top of the cerebral cortex. So we have these four parts: a sensory brain, an emotional brain, a thinking brain, and a motor or action brain. And it's interesting to know about the brain and its functioning regions, but it might be too narrow an understanding to suppose that our minds depend totally on these neurons and neural pathways. So just going to... Just get you to sort of take a few moments to look back over your day today. So recall your day, today Wednesday, and see if you can recall a time when you had a feeling that was really noticeable, a positive, negative, or neutral feeling, or an emotion or mood that you experienced. And what you might notice, it seems to be easier for us to remember what we did, what activities we did, or what we thought, than what we felt in the body or what our emotions were. But if you can just sort of look back through the day, and if something comes to mind, a feeling or an emotion, and just review, how did it arise? What triggered it? And how intense was it? Where did you feel it in your body? And could it be put in the category of greed or lust, wanting something or craving something, or the category of anger or aversion, or delusion, confusion? Was it related to a state of mind, distraction, focus, calm? And how long did it last? When did it disappear? And did you notice it disappearing? Now, if we can just divide into groups of three, what I'm going to suggest is that each person just take a turn to discuss what came up for you. So you can just, whatever you just remembered about that, a feeling or emotion, how it came, how long it lasted, how it went away, if you notice the triggers. If nothing came to you or that's too difficult to talk about, you could also talk about what your understanding is of mind, what is mind. Okay, so we can get just groups of three. Hello. So it'll be about 9 minutes. 9 minutes, yeah. And this is a bit of... 40 seconds, okay. Oh, wait. Be mindful for 40 seconds. Here we are. All right. So I'm just going to close this session with a poem. It's one that a friend sent to me recently, and it's a little bit of a whimsical poem, which in some ways pokes fun at our efforts to define or categorize our minds, our thoughts, and emotions. But it also shows how interrelated and visceral they are. It's by an American poet, comic, and writer named John Rodel. And it's called The Anatomy of Peace, formerly titled How to Live with My Body. My brain and heart divorced a decade ago over who was to blame about how big of a mess I have become. Eventually, they couldn't be in the same room with each other. Now my head and heart share custody of me. I stay with my brain during the week, and my heart gets me on weekends. They never speak to one another. Instead, they give me the same note to pass to each other every week. And their notes say, the notes they send to one another always say the same things. This is all your fault. On Sundays, my heart complains about how my head has let me down in the past. And on Wednesdays, my head lists all of the times my heart has screwed things up for me in the future. They blame each other for my state of life. There's been a lot of yelling and crying. So lately, I've been spending a lot of time with my gut, who serves as my unofficial therapist. Most nights, I sneak out of the window in my rib cage and slide down my spine and collapse on my gut's plush leather chair that's always open for me. And I just sit until the sun comes up. Last evening, my gut asked me if I was having a hard time being caught between my heart and my head. I nodded. I said I didn't know if I could live with either of them anymore. My heart is always sad about something that happened yesterday, while my head is always worried about something that may happen tomorrow, I lamented. My gut squeezed my hand. I just can't live with my mistakes of the past or my anxiety about the future, I sighed. My gut smiled and said, in that case, you should go stay with your lungs for a while. I was confused. The look on my face gave it away. If you are exhausted about your heart's obsession with the fixed past and your mind's focus on the uncertain future, your lungs are the perfect place for you. There is no yesterday in your lungs. There is no tomorrow there either. There is only now. There is only inhale, there is only exhale. There is only this moment. There is only breath. And in that breath, you can rest while your heart and head work their relationship out. This morning, while my brain was busy reading tea leaves, and while my heart was staring at old photographs, I packed a little bag and walked to the door of my lungs. Before I could even knock, she opened the door with a smile, and as a gust of air embraced me, she said, "What took you so long?"